This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Book 4 in The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Passage of Power, by Robert A. Carroll. Performed by Grover Gardner. Chapter 5. The LBJ Special. During the campaign that followed the convention, the campaign between the Kennedy-Johnson ticket and the Republican slate of Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, it was important to Jack Kennedy's chances that there be harmony. So when, the very morning after the vice presidential nomination, Robert Kennedy bumped into George Reedy, he said in the friendliest manner, "Everything's all right now, George." Following a joint planning session at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport, and the rump session of Congress, which, with its true purpose now gone, accomplished nothing, not one of the four major legislative proposals brought up was passed, Kennedy and Johnson opened the campaign by appearing together on Labor Day in Boston, and later that week in cities across Texas. And the two candidates thereafter waged largely separate campaigns, on the same platform only a few times during the 2 months before Election Day. There was a minimum of interaction or friction between the Kennedy and Johnson camps. Johnson's job was to hold the South, or to be more precise, since Eisenhower had won 5 of the 11 states of the old Confederacy in 1956, to win it back. A tough assignment due to Southern misgivings about the strong civil rights platform the Democrats had adopted in Los Angeles, and due also to Kennedy's liberalism, civil rights views, and religion. Kennedy's hope that he had settled the religious question for good in the West Virginia primary proved, in Theodore White's word, naive. By September, the old fears were boiling to the surface. The reports from the South were bad. Baptist ministers had begun to preach against the Church of Rome and its candidate. Though Kennedy lanced the boil again in a speech before the Greater Houston Ministerial Association, under the surface the issue still festered. A Gallup poll at the end of September found the Kennedy-Johnson and Nixon-Lodge tickets in a dead heat in the South. 46% to 46%, with 8% undecided. Johnson's campaign in the South included some very tough behind-the-scenes arguments to the most influential Southern Democrats, such as the handful of key Florida leaders he flew to Miami to meet, in a very private meeting. So far behind did Kennedy's private polls show him in that state that he had all but written it off. But Johnson, his face grim and his eyes blazing, told the Florida leaders that "this boy Kennedy is going to win, and he's going to win big, and if he wins without the South, I'm warning you, you bastards are going to be dead. You'll get nothing out of the next Congress, and you won't get anything out of the Kennedy administration." And after that, columnist Drew Pearson was to write, Florida's top Democrats really began to work. And his campaign included a whistle-stop train tour down through the South on a 13-car LBJ special, pulled by two locomotives that chugged out of Washington's Union Station in mid-October, to spend 5 days wending its slow way through the little towns and cities of 8 southern states. He designed the format for the stops himself, and as George Reedy put it, they were potent. As the LBJ special entered the outskirts of a town, its public address system would be switched on, and over it would come the stirring strains of the Yellow Rose of Texas. At first the tune would be played at low volume, but as the train approached the town's center, where advance men would have gathered a small crowd, the volume would be turned up to a point where the tune could be heard from blocks away. Record player and engine would stop simultaneously. A dark blue curtain that had been hung over the doorway onto the rear platform would be pulled aside, and the tall figure of Lyndon Johnson, waving a 10-gallon hat, would step through. Following him would be the town's mayor and sheriff and perhaps the district's congressman and other local dignitaries, and Johnson would introduce them, perhaps say a word or two about one or another, and then shake their hands as they stepped down from the platform into the midst of their constituents. Then he himself would be introduced, in introductions that emphasized that he was from the South and the significance of that fact. Tennessee's governor, Buford Ellington, who made a lot of the introductions, riding the train for the entire 5 days, would tell the audience that the platform adopted in Los Angeles didn't really matter. The main thing is to have a Southerner on the ticket. Or an introduction might remind the crowd that Kennedy had been attacked for putting a Southerner on the ticket. "Are we going to sit idly by while this great Southerner is abused in this manner?" Virginia's governor, John S. Battle, demanded at one stop. And Johnson would step forward, sometimes throwing his Stetson into the crowd, where an advance man was supposed to retrieve it and bring it back. Stetsons were expensive. Sometimes simply placing it conspicuously on the railing in front of him, to say he was happy to be back in the land we love with the people we love. Although he would then add that, "In our campaign, there's no north, south, east, or west. It's for all America." His talks were brief, 10 or 15 minutes generally, but very Southern in their message. "Why, oh why, should the great state of Virginia ever vote Republican?" he asked at one stop. "This high-talking, high-spending crowd has never done anything for the South. It has no interest in Virginia or any other Southern state. What excuse have you got for not voting with the party of your fathers?" Often he told his audience that he had come because he had been reading about Southern defections to the Republicans. "We just decided we'd come down and see who deserted us and where they've gone." Or he would talk about his daddy, his father, who had been dying in a hospital, but when he, Lyndon, had come to see him, had said, "Son, get me my britches, I'm going home." He had reminded his daddy that he would get better medical care in the hospital, Lyndon would say, but his daddy had said, "I want to go back among our people, where they know when a man's sick and they care when he dies." "That is the difference between Democrats and Republicans," Johnson would say. "Democrats do care when a man is sick, and they care when he dies, and Democrats care year in and year out." "Republicans care too," he said, "just before every election time." And his talks were very Southern in their delivery, old-fashioned stump speeches, real stem winders, shouted out with the points he wanted to make delivered in a bellow, so that his voice was continually hoarse, and as he shouted his arms flailed, and he would raise an arm or two high above his head and jab a finger toward the sky. Among his gestures was one in which, a reporter wrote, the Johnson hands went up behind his ears and wavered there like a television commercial on headache misery. And some of the points he made were unforgettable, for if Lyndon Johnson reading from a prepared speech was stilted and unconvincing, Lyndon Johnson without a speech, Lyndon Johnson alone with an audience he had to persuade, was still the Lyndon Johnson who had, in his early Texas campaigns, shown that in a state with a history of great stump speakers, he was one of the greatest of them all. Was the religious issue, Kennedy's Catholicism, a menace to the Democrats? Jack Kennedy had met the issue in his way with the carefully reasoned speech to the ministers in Houston. Lyndon Johnson met it in his way. The hate campaign being waged against Jack Kennedy because of religion was a shame, he said, particularly the attacks by Baptist preachers from the pulpit. Jack Kennedy had had an older brother, Joe Jr., he told the huddles of people at the whistle-stop towns of the South. Jack Kennedy had loved Joe Jr., he said. But Joe Jr. was dead now. He had been killed in the war. He had been killed when he volunteered to pilot a plane on a suicide mission. And when Jack's brother took off that morning on that mission from which he knew he would never return, nobody asked him what church he went to. And after he died, after he went down in a burning plane over the English Channel so that we could have free speech and a free press and live as free men, not a soul got up in a pulpit and asked what church he went to. And as Lyndon Johnson told the story of Jack's brother, his voice wavered and almost broke, and in town after town, a deep hush fell over the crowd gathered around the train platform. As he was talking, Lyndon Johnson had, of course, gotten worked up, and often, as the train pulled out, with the yellow rose blaring again, he would think of additional points he wanted to make, and with the train already in motion and pulling away from the crowd, he would turn back to the microphone, waving and shouting to make them, so that as the train disappeared down the tracks, the sound of his voice remained behind with its final message, as when he shouted while the train was chugging away from the station in a little town in Virginia named Culpeper, "Goodbye, Culpeper! Vote Democratic! What has Dick Nixon ever done for Culpeper?" Since often the public address system was still turned on as the train left, his audiences could also hear his asides to his staff. "Goodbye, Greer," he shouted to a little South Carolina town rapidly vanishing down the tracks. "Goodbye, Greer. God bless you, Greer. Bobby, turn off that yellow rose. God bless you, Greer. Vote Democratic. Bobby, turn off that fucking yellow rose." So wound up would he become that sometimes, at the end of the day, he couldn't stop talking. One day, his last stop was in Atlanta, Georgia, and the special didn't pull into the yards behind Atlanta's terminal station, where a small crowd was waiting on the cross ties, until after 11 o'clock. He was still speaking at midnight when he was drowned out by a loud hiss as the train's engineer shut down its air brake for the night. His speech was very effective, reported Eugene Patterson of the Atlanta Constitution. What he was doing was speaking the language. He was likable. He was folksy, earthy. It was clear what his job is, to speak to the people in their own tongue while Kennedy addresses his broad A to the ages. Kennedy looks good on the white horse. Johnson dominates the caboose. And while the engineer had cut off Lyndon Johnson's speaking for the day, there were other means of campaigning. Grabbing a packet of Kennedy-Johnson campaign cards from an aide, Johnson climbed down from the rear platform and, leaning comfortably against the steps, started handing them to the people filing by, like a blackjack dealer dealing cards. His fawn Stetson sat on the back of his head, a reporter wrote. A quizzical smile, hinting of spoofery, played around his mouth and eyes under the bright light. A card here, a card there, when he would lick his thumb and deal. Imagine a blend of Harry Truman and Marshall Dillon dealing a hand of poker in the railroad yard near midnight, and you've got a picture of Lyndon Johnson's visit to Atlanta. He seemed to like what he was doing, Patterson wrote, and the crowd liked him. And as that very perceptive reporter Mary McGrory of the Washington Evening Star put it, effective as Johnson was as a Southern stump speaker, the senator was doing his best work not on the observation platform of the train's last car, but in the car in front of that one, which she called the train's equivalent of the Senate cloakroom. A Southern reporter called it a portable, smoke-filled room. That car, a parlor car with roomy, comfortable seats, was filled with Southern politicians, a constantly changing cast of politicians. The local dignitaries who stepped out onto the rear platform with Johnson and got off in their town had boarded the train at the previous town, climbing into the parlor car to be offered drinks by Johnson's pretty secretaries and have impressively large official party badges pinned to their lapels. As soon as Johnson had finished his speech in that town, he and Lady Bird had come back into the parlor car to have their picture taken with the officials, and he would chat with them, charm them, and warn them what would happen to the South if Nixon won, or if Kennedy won without its support. Then there would be an announcement. 5 minutes till the next stop. The secretaries would line up the officials behind Johnson, and they would walk into the rear car, and then to the rear door of the train. And as the yellow rose blared and the train pulled into their town's station, would come out on the rear platform behind him, in front of their constituents, waving to them as if, as befitted their importance, they had been aboard the train for a long time, and would climb down into the midst of the hometown crowd. For a moment the parlor car would be empty, except for the secretaries. And then, as Johnson began his speech, a new group of dignitaries, from the next town down the line, would come aboard, climbing into the parlor car, to be handed their drinks and badges. The efficiency of this technique maximized its impact. During the 5 days that the LBJ special chugged through the Southland, the incredible number of 1,247 dignitaries, governors, senators, congressmen, state legislators, mayors, councilmen, sheriffs, bankers, businessmen, and other pillars of local communities, were entertained in that parlor car. And maximizing its impact also was the unique ability of its host. After interviewing a group of local officials who had just descended from the train, McGrory summarized their comments. In explaining the political realities, he remains peerless. Coverage of the LBJ special in northern papers was relatively cursory and tinged with condescension. Among themselves, reporters had dubbed the train the Cornpone Special. but in the South, the headlines grew steadily larger. Johnson hailed by SC crowds. Lady Bird makes big hit at press session. Southern demo politicos flocking to Johnson's special. Candidate for Vice President of U.S. to be in Greenville, 525 today. Johnson makes fiery talk here. Johnson brings campaign to Meridian. Johnson speaks here today. LBJ's special caravan, sharp, efficient show. LBJ on way, parade slated. And so did the crowds. 2,000 in Clemson, 3,000 in Meridian, 5,000 in Gaffney, until, in the end of the trip climax, Johnson led and then reviewed a Mardi Gras preview parade in New Orleans before 100,000 spectators. And the tour accomplished its purpose. Republican strategists saw its effect. The astute White House counsel Bryce Harlow told Nixon that he was being religioned right out of this campaign. Lyndon is talking religion at every stop. You're just flat losing the campaign on religion. It's a calculated stance. Kennedy can't talk it. Lyndon can, and Lyndon's talking it. Southern Democrat politicians aboard the LBJ special were saying that, as Mary McGrory reported, 2 weeks earlier the Republicans would have won the election in the South, if it had been held then, but that now the South had rejoined the flock. Skeptical though she had been when the tour started, at its conclusion McGrory wrote that Lyndon Johnson has justified his existence on the Democratic ticket. Said another observer, this master of the political coup has done it again. Holding his own state, or to be more precise, bringing it back into the Democratic column after Eisenhower's lopsided victories there, was perhaps the toughest job of all. The anger of the state's conservatives over his decision to join Kennedy's ticket and thereby in effect run on the liberal Democratic platform had only intensified since the convention. Signs with the word Judas on them had been waved at his every appearance in Texas. As always with Lyndon Johnson, the specter of humiliation loomed before him. Writing John Connolly on October 18th that he was deeply disturbed about Texas, he added, "We just must not win the nation and lose Texas. Imagine when we win how the next administration will look upon us." The ever-haunting fear of losing Texas never left him for a second, Jim Rowe was to recall. He was wound up tight like a top. When he and Lady Bird arrived in Dallas on November 4th, 4 days before the election, to attend a Democratic rally in the Adolphus Hotel, it appeared the fear might well prove justified. His private polls were showing the Democratic ticket to be slightly, but clearly, behind. On that day, however, he got a break. An hour before the Democratic rally, there had been a Republican event at the Adolphus, attended mainly by wealthy right-wingers. Many of the women were Dallas Junior Leaguers, wearing red, white, and blue Nixon costumes. Hearing that the Johnsons would be arriving shortly, they crowded into the hotel's lobby, their hatred simmering, joining a group of placard-carrying men who had been organized by the state's only Republican congressman, Bruce Alger of Dallas. And as Lyndon and Lady Bird entered the lobby, they swarmed around them, shouting and cursing. Alger was raising and lowering his big sign. LBJ sold out to Yankee socialists like a piston, and it came dangerously close to Lady Bird's head. One woman snatched the gloves out of Lady Bird's hand and threw them on the floor, and there was spitting in her direction. At one point, she fell several steps behind her husband, and there was a frightened expression on her face. Several Dallas policemen were escorting the Johnsons, but Lyndon told them to stand aside, and when General Carl L. Finney, commander of the Texas National Guard, tried to step between Johnson and the demonstrators, Johnson said, "I want you to get away from me." It took the Johnsons 30 minutes to negotiate the 75 feet between the front door of the Adolphus and the elevators that took them up to the ballroom, where 2,000 Democrats were waiting to greet them. Not everyone who witnessed the scene was sure it had had to take that long. LBJ and Lady Bird could have gone through that lobby and got on the elevator in 5 minutes, but LBJ took 30 minutes to go through that crowd, and it was all being recorded and played for television and radio and newspapers, and he knew it and played it for all it was worth, says D.B. Hardiman, Rayburn's aide and a Johnson admirer. Bill Moyers says, "He knew it got votes for him. He could never have calculated that scene or fixed that situation or arranged for it. He didn't know how he was going to carry Texas, and he greatly feared losing Texas because he thought it would discredit him totally in the nation and with Kennedy. If he could have thought this up, he would have thought it up, tried to invent it, but the moment it happened, he knew." Some Johnson admirers feel that was the reason he sent the policeman away. But whatever the reason, television that evening showed Lady Bird's frightened face and Lyndon saying at the Democratic rally that he had told the police to leave because, "I wanted to find out if the time had come when I couldn't walk with my lady through the corridors of the hotels of Dallas." The incident turned the tide in Texas. Editorials in newspapers across the state echoed the Abilene Reporter News comment that, "A mob in Dallas yesterday wrote a new chapter that stands to the shame of our state and people, of whatever political shade." The next day, the Johnsons flew to Houston. Ashton Ganella recalls that, "We had been told ahead of time that it, Houston, was really going to be ugly to us because they were very conservative. Up to then, Texas had really not been that much for Kennedy Johnson." When the Johnson plane arrived at the Houston airport, however, it couldn't have been more overwhelming. Everybody had signs. "We apologize. We love you." And during the remaining time before the election, the Johnsons were greeted everywhere in Texas with standing ovations. Lyndon Johnson had something else on his side in Texas. His investment in George Parr was paying off. In the election, on November 8th, the Kennedy-Johnson ticket carried Texas, 1,167,932 votes to 1,121,699. Kennedy won by 46,233 votes out of 2,311,670 cast, winning 50.5% of the votes to 48.5% for Nixon. 1% were cast for candidates of two minor parties. Hardly had the votes been tallied when Texas Republicans charged that tens of thousands of them were fraudulent, and that tens of thousands of other votes, legitimate votes, had fraudulently been invalidated and not counted. The GOP complaints dealt not primarily with the state's big cities. Nixon carried Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston by almost 100,000 votes, where voting machines were used, but rather with the scores of counties in which voting was still by paper ballot, and in which voters had to sign numbered poll lists, which made it possible for officials to know for whom they had cast their ballots, making a mockery of the concept of the secret ballot. Well over half the ballots cast in Texas in 1960 were paper. GOP complaints about most of the state centered on a technicality. Under a new state law, the 1960 election was the first time it was in effect. Voters who used paper ballots were required not only to mark the candidate of their choice, but also to cross off the candidates they opposed. Not only the candidate of the other major party, but the candidates of the two minor parties as well. Although one of the law's other provisions allowed judges to count votes, even if this requirement was not complied with, if the voter's intent was clear, the GOP, noting that the long-time Democratic dominance in the state meant that the election machinery, from precinct judges to the State Board of Election canvassers, was overwhelmingly Democratic, charged that in pro-Nixon precincts many ballots were invalidated, in pro-Kennedy precincts far fewer. Republicans said that a spot check of just 94 precincts showed that 59,000 ballots had been invalidated. In some precincts, heavily pro-Nixon, the disqualification rate was 50%, they said. About certain areas of Texas, however, the sprawling Mexican-American slum in San Antonio that was known as the West Side, and the impoverished Mexican-American counties south of San Antonio in the lower Rio Grande Valley that formed the border between Texas and Mexico, the Republican complaints were not about technicalities. In these areas, then known in a Texas political euphemism as the ethnic bloc, Mexican-American Catholics made up a substantial portion of the population, and the Kennedy edge in these areas has been generally attributed to his Catholicism, as well as to the activism of the younger Mexican-American World War II veterans who had established Viva Kennedy committees. Kennedy's Catholicism, the Texas Observer noted, had contributed to his victory in the 39 counties throughout Texas in which Catholics comprised a majority of the population. While Eisenhower had carried 28 of them in 1956, Kennedy carried 35 in 1960. This analysis, however, omits the factor considered decisive by some Texas political figures, including the two key ones, John Connally, who would in 1962 be elected the state's governor, and Edward A. Clark, the one-time Secretary of State and long-time secret boss of the state, a factor whose significance is demonstrated by the fact that, while in the Catholic counties outside the San Antonio-Rio Grande areas, the shift from the Republican ticket in 1956 to the Democratic ticket in 1960 fell generally within limits that might be expected in elections held in a democracy. In San Antonio and the Rio Grande counties, the shift was outside those limits, and the majorities recorded for the Kennedy-Johnson ticket were startling in comparison with those recorded in the previous presidential election. In that 1956 election, San Antonio, which used voting machines, supported the Republican ticket by a margin of 12,000 votes. In 1960, it supported the Democratic ticket by a margin of 19,000 votes. This is a reversal of 31,000, former San Antonio Congressman Paul Kilday wrote Johnson. We are quite proud of the results. The reversal was due largely to results from the West Side, which was run with an iron hand by Kilday's brother, Sheriff Owen Kilday. The West Side went for Kennedy Johnson by a margin of 17,017 to 2,982, just over 14,000 votes. In one precinct, or box, in that area, which had given Eisenhower a substantial majority in 1956, sentiment had evidently changed. Kennedy won 1,325 to 123. Other West Side boxes recorded margins for Kennedy of 880 to 55 and 799 to 48. In the adjoining precinct 13, it was 463 to 33. The vote for Barr County as a whole was 75,298 for the Democratic ticket, 63,931 for the Republican. In the Valley border counties, the results were even more dramatic. For decades, as I wrote in Means of Ascent, the results reported from the ethnic towns had little to do with the preferences of the Mexican Americans. The overwhelming majority of their votes had been cast at the orders of the Anglo-Saxon border dictators called patrones or jefes, orders often enforced by armed pistoleros who herded Mexican Americans to the polls, told them how to vote, and then accompanied them to the voting cubbyholes to make sure the instructions were followed. If indeed the votes had been actually cast at all. In some of the Mexican-American areas, the local border dictators, in Texas political parlance, didn't vote 'em, but rather just counted 'em. In those areas, most of the voters didn't even go to the polls. The Jefe's men would, as one observer put it, simply go around to the Mexicans' homes, get the numbers of their poll tax receipts, tell them not to go to the polls, just write in 100 numbers and cast 100 votes yourself. Or, after the polls closed, would simply take the tally sheets and add to the recorded total whatever number was needed to give their favored candidate the margin he desired. You get down on the border and it didn't matter how people, the Mexican Americans, felt, Ed Clark would explain, the leaders did it all. They could vote 'em or count 'em. Either one. Between 1948 and 1960, little had changed. In the latter election, as in the former, George Parr counted them for Lyndon Johnson. The first sign was the pace of the counting. By the evening of Election Day, several hours after polls had closed, veteran reporters had noticed what one called the slow-motion count of votes in Duval. They knew what that meant, that the Duke was holding back a final tally until he saw whether the race was close, so that if it was, he could give his allies the votes they needed. At midnight, only one of Duval's 10 precincts had reported a final tally. Then, finally, came the count itself. The Duke controlled not only Duval County, but Starr County as well as a personal fiefdom. Duval voted for Kennedy Johnson by a margin of 3,803 to 808, Starr by 4,051 to 284. In a petition for a recount filed with the state canvassing board 3 days after the election, Republicans charged that pistols were carried by election judges and others in Duval County so that voters were intimidated and coerced. Then there was Jim Wells County, or to be precise, the county's Precinct 13, Box 13, the precinct already legendary in Texas political history that in 1948 had provided the decisive margin for Lyndon Johnson by giving him 200 new votes, the votes that were cast in alphabetical order and all in the same handwriting 6 days after the polls had closed. The Mexican-American reform movement had taken control of most of Jim Wells from Parr, but not the 13th Precinct, the poorest Mexican district in the county seat of Alice. In 1960, that box gave Lyndon Johnson's ticket a margin of 1,144 to 45, or 25 to 1. So the ticket came out of the heart of Duke's Rio Grande domain with more than 88% of the vote, and a plurality of more than 7,800 votes. The results were almost as lopsided in the counties controlled by Parr's allies, who followed his lead. In Webb County, it was 10,059 to 1,802, more than 5 to 1. In Jim Hogg County, 1,255 to 244, more than 5 to 1. In Brooks, 1,934 to 540, almost 4 to 1. The nine counties controlled by Parr and his allies reported a total of 37,063 votes to the Texas Election Bureau. Almost 30,000 of them, 29,377, or 79%, were for Kennedy Johnson. The Democratic ticket, therefore, came out of those counties with a plurality of 21,691. For the nine counties, Starr, Duval, Webb, Jim Hogg, Jim Wells, Brooks, Maverick, LaSalle, and Zapata, the major party totals were 37,063 votes, of which Kennedy Johnson received 29,377, or 79.3%, and Nixon Lodge received 7,686, or 20.7%. In contrast to the 21,691 plurality, in 1956 these counties had given a plurality of only 7,432 votes to the Democratic ticket. One charge of vote-buying and voter-herding, Earl Mazo reported in the New York Herald Tribune, involves some Democratic leaders who are said to have purchased poll tax certificates in blocks of 300 to 3,000 at $1.75 for each certificate for use in precincts near the Mexican border, precincts which, he noted, produced sizable Democratic majorities. There was, the GOP alleged, no secrecy in voting in these areas. In Precinct 8 of Benavides in Duval County, a local machine supervisor kept a list of persons voting against the machine. The Valley Patrons, who had given Johnson huge majorities in his 1941 and 1948 Senate races, and who would have done so in his 1954 race had they been needed, were still for Johnson, Clark and Connolly explained. The Valley was still strictly LBJ country, Duval County political operative O.P. Carrillo was to say. Catholicism was not the key, Connolly says. The basic core of the Johnson adherents in the Hispanic community, he meant Parr and his allies, were all still there, in 1960, and still loyal to him. When Clark was asked about the role of Catholicism and the Viva Kennedy organizations in the vote in Parr's Valley domain, he gave a slight smile, shook his head no, and said that rather, our old friends stood by us. Most important, George Parr had stood by Lyndon Johnson, and the reason, says Clark, was the Supreme Court decision. He were grateful for the reversal, Clark was to say in his East Texas patois. In the aftermath of Lyndon Johnson's 1948 election victory, an investigation had been conducted by federal masters in chancery, appointed by a federal judge. The chancery hearings were cut short by an order from United States Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black after arguments were made before him by Abe Fortas. Enough witnesses had testified so that one of the masters, the only one to comment, was to conclude, "I think Lyndon was put in the United States Senate with a stolen election." No investigation was ever made of the 1960 results. The Republican petition, alleging numerous and widespread frauds, was brought before the three-man state canvassing board, whose members were Governor Price Daniel, Attorney General Will Wilson, and the board's chairman, Secretary of State Zolly Stakely, three of Johnson's most active supporters in the campaign. Daniel and Wilson had been on the same ballot with him. Stakely said Texas law gave the board no authority to investigate the returns, and hearings were simply delayed until after December 19th, when the National Electoral College, using the totals furnished to them by the various states, the Texas total by the canvassing board, certified the overall vote. The truth of the Republican allegations was never examined in the depth necessary to ascertain their validity, as was also the case in Dick Daley's Illinois, where the results were even closer and where widespread fraud was also alleged. The attention focused on fraud in the 1960 presidential campaign has, during the intervening half-century, centered on Illinois, not Texas. The Republican allegations, not only about voting in the Valley, but about the invalidating of ballots under the new state law, have never been examined in the depth necessary to ascertain their validity, much less to determine how many votes were affected if indeed the allegations were true. Nor have the many other factors, from demographic shifts in the state's population to the scene in the Adolphus Hotel, ever been examined in the necessary depth. Today, the passage of time has made it difficult, impossible, really, to ascertain, in trying to assess the election results in Texas, the weight that should be assigned in an equation that contains so many factors to the vote from the ethnic bloc. Paul Kilday wrote of the 31,000 vote reversal in San Antonio, which of course included the 14,000 vote plurality the Kilday machine produced in that city's west side. It would be misleading to speak of a reversal in the Valley, since George Parr and his allies could simply produce whatever result they wanted there. But Parr had demonstrated before that when he became angry at what he construed to be an inadequate lack of allegiance by some public official, he would retaliate in the next election by throwing the Valley's block vote to the official's opponent. How he might have reacted had Lyndon Johnson not assisted with his court case can be today, long after his death, a matter only for speculation, since, so far as the author can determine, no historian or journalist raised the matter with him before his death. But the point is moot in any event. Johnson produced the legal help and Parr produced the votes, the 21,000 plurality, 31,000 and 21,000. In an election that was decided by 46,000 votes, the weight of those votes could hardly have been a minor factor. Whatever the explanation for the results from the ethnic bloc in Texas, John Kennedy had selected Lyndon Johnson in part to take back Texas for the Democratic presidential ticket. And Johnson had done it. He had taken back the South, too. Republicans were stunned by their poor showing in Dixie, Evans and Novak were to write. Before Johnson was nominated, Republican strategists had been confident, in a confidence bolstered by poll results, that Nixon would hold all five of the former Confederate states that Eisenhower had carried in 1956, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, Tennessee, and Virginia, and would pick up the two Carolinas as well, for a total of seven. In the event, it was Kennedy who carried seven. Nixon won only three southern states, Florida, Tennessee, and Virginia. Mississippi voted for a slate of independent electors. Texas and Louisiana were brought back into the Democratic column, and both Carolinas stayed there, by very narrow margins. There were southwestern and border states in which Johnson's presence on the ticket may have been crucial. New Mexico's Clinton Anderson was to say flatly that without Johnson, that state would have gone Republican. And in Missouri, as U.S. News and World Report reported, Johnson is given much of the credit for the narrow Democratic victory. But it is not necessary to go beyond the South in showing his impact on the result. Together, the Carolinas had 22 electoral votes, Louisiana 10, and of course, there were Texas's 24, a total of 56 votes. The electoral vote by which Kennedy defeated Nixon was 303 to 219. Had those four states gone Republican, Kennedy would have had 247 electoral votes, and Nixon would have had 275. On a national scale, of course, other factors were more significant in the 1960 campaign. Kennedy's triumph over Nixon in the televised debates, his courageous speech before the ministers in Houston, the telephone call he made to Martin Luther King's wife when the minister was arrested in Atlanta, the style, the elegance, the wit, the charisma of the handsome, debonair candidate that brought larger and larger and more frenzied crowds out to greet him in the cities of the Northeast. Despite all these factors, however, Kennedy might not have been elected president without Johnson. John F. Kennedy could not have been elected president without the South, Evans and Novak were to conclude. Could he have carried enough Southern states to win without Johnson on the ticket? Probably not. The key to the election had been in the South, said U.S. News and World Report. And this was the land of Lyndon Johnson. It had backed him for the presidency, and he had been put on the Kennedy ticket to hold it for the Democrats. Mr. Johnson did the job. He campaigned and cajoled and persuaded, and wound up by getting almost all of the top-level Democrats in the South out fighting for the ticket. In Kennedy's suite at the Biltmore Hotel the morning after his nomination, the Southern governors had told him, one after the other, that the only way to hold their states was to put Johnson on the ticket. Kennedy had put him on, and the states had been held. 81 of the South's 128 electoral votes had gone to Kennedy Johnson. Nixon had received only 33. 14 went to Mississippi's independent slate. As the decades have rolled by since that election, the picture of the Kennedy campaign, etched at the time by the journalists traveling with it and by the campaign's first and most famous chronicler, Theodore H. White, became a staple of American political legend. Lyndon Johnson was only peripherally a part of that legend. In the 173 pages in The Making of the President 1960 that White devoted to the post-convention campaign, the Adolphus incident is mentioned only in a phrase, as was Johnson's role in the South as a whole. His name appears in those pages exactly 7 times, always as a brief mention. In a vivid portrait of efficiency and sophistication, of Ivy League charm and a group of brilliant young men transforming American politics, what room remained for a tall, thick, bellowing figure with his arms flailing above his head, shouting, "What has Dick Nixon ever done for Culpeper?" For the endless blaring repetition of "The Yellow Rose of Texas," for the Corn Pone Special. In the years since White's book established the terms of reference by which the 1960 campaign is considered, there has been scant reference to the scene at the Adolphus. Even in discussions of possible fraud in the election, and of how it might have changed the overall result, it had been Illinois on which most of the focus had remained, not those border counties down on the Rio Grande. But Johnson should have been a part of the Chronicles, as one of Kennedy's intimates, Ted Sorensen, the only one really to give Johnson more than passing mention, acknowledges. Noting that Kennedy's margin of victory in Texas had been 46,000, and that a switch in votes by 23,000 voters would therefore have turned the tide, Sorensen wrote that the maltreatment to which he, Johnson, and his wife were subjected by a shoving and booing crowd of disorderly Republican fanatics in Dallas undoubtedly helped switch more than the 23,000. And had it not been for the return of Texas and Louisiana to the Democratic column, and for the Carolinas staying Democratic against a predicted Republican victory, Nixon would have won the election. Kennedy had gambled on Lyndon Johnson, Sorensen wrote. That gamble paid off. Jack Kennedy himself was to say to Ken O'Donnell in 1962, "You have to admit I was right. We couldn't have won without him." On election night, from Austin, Johnson made a call to Jack Kennedy. "I hear you are losing Ohio. I am carrying Texas, and we are doing fine in Pennsylvania." Kennedy turned away from the phone with a smile. "We?" It was he who was going to be president. Lyndon Johnson was going to be vice president. Part 2. Rufus Cornpone. Chapter 6. Power is where power goes. Power is where power goes, the most significant factor in any equation that adds up to political power, Lyndon Johnson had assured his allies, is the individual, not the office. For a man with a gift for acquiring power, whatever office he held would become powerful, because of what he would make out of it. Johnson felt he had that gift. "I do understand power, whatever else may be said about me," he had once told an aide. "I know where to look for it and how to use it." And nothing in his career, at least nothing in his career before he began running for the presidency, made that assessment seem immodest. At every stage in his life, from college onward, he had demonstrated not only that he possessed the gift, but that he possessed it in a particularly rare and creative form. The ability to look at an organization that had little or no political power, to perceive it in political potentialities that no one else had ever seen, to acquire a position in the organization, and then to transform the organization into a political force, so that the office he held, and he as its holder, became powerful. At every stage, the gift had been maximized by the ruthlessness with which he grabbed for the power he perceived, and with which he wielded the power once he had it. But nothing could diminish the brilliance of the perception. At college, a sleepy teacher's college deep in the Texas Hill Country, the organization was a small social club, the White Stars. Becoming its leader, he turned it into a political organization, disciplined and secret, brought it into campus politics. He created campus politics, really. Previously, no one even cared about campus elections. And through means that included a stolen election and the use against a young woman student of what his lieutenants called blackmail, made himself, an extremely unpopular young man on College Hill, the student with the most influence there. Then he persuaded the college president to give him a say over which students would get campus jobs. At this poor boys' school, the choice was often stark: get a teaching diploma or live out a life of drudgery on your family's lonely farm or ranch. The wages from a campus job were often a student's only hope of paying his tuition. 20 cents an hour and you either went to school or you didn't, one says, and Lyndon would say who would get that job. The gift worked on Capitol Hill as well as on College Hill. There the organization was the Little Congress, an almost moribund debating society of congressional aides that had degenerated into little more than a poorly attended social club, and the office he acquired was its speaker. After Johnson won that office in an election in 1933 that also would not bear close scrutiny, the organization was transformed. An invitation to address it now prized in Washington, and the speaker became one congressional aide who had access to powerful congressmen and senators, and prestige as well. Seeing Johnson striding self-importantly down a Capitol corridor, a newly arrived congressional aide asked who he was, and was told, "That's the boss of the Little Congress." The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, with 2 employees and little cash, was in 1940 another almost moribund organization that no one took seriously, except Lyndon Johnson. The junior congressman saw 2 things that no one else saw. The first was a possible connection between 2 groups that had previously had no link: conservative Texas oilmen and contractors, most notably his financial backer, Herman Brown of Brown and Root, who needed federal contracts and tax breaks and were willing to spend money, a lot of money, to get them, and the scores of northern liberal congressmen running for re-election who needed money for their campaigns. The second was that he could become that link, although the only position he could obtain with the committee was a vague, informal one, without any title at all. With it, he forged the link, made himself the conduit through which the Texas contributions passed, the congressman to whom, junior or not, other congressmen had to appeal for campaign financing. By the end of the 1940 campaign, the committee had become a key funding source, and at the age of 32, he had his first toehold on national power. Hardly had he arrived in the Senate in 1949 after the most notorious of his elections, when he began seeking the post of his party's assistant leader, or whip. 2 years later, he got it easily. No one else wanted it. It was, everyone agreed, a nothing job. But Johnson made it a significant job, and then became leader, a position historically so powerless. "I have nothing to threaten them with, nothing to promise them," one of his immediate predecessors as leader had said. But no one really wanted that job either. The most influential and respected senators routinely refused to take it. Previous leaders' inability to actually lead the Senate, or even to control it, had for years made leaders figures of ridicule. Johnson took it, sought it, maneuvered for it, and so transformed it that a journalist watching him run the Senate said he seemed to be running the world. And journalists in general bestowed on him the title, the second most powerful man in the country. All his life, Lyndon Johnson had been taking nothing jobs and making them into something, something big. And now, no sooner had he been elected to the vice presidency than he tried to do the same thing with that office. The Constitution of the United States says that the vice president shall preside over the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. It says that in case of the president's death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president. And in regard to the powers of a vice president, that is all it says. The 12th Amendment to the Constitution adopted in 1794 says that he shall open the envelopes containing the certifications from the various states of their electoral votes in presidential elections. But opening them, and perhaps announcing the results, the amendment is unclear about that, is his only function in this ceremony. The 25th Amendment, dealing with the death or disability of a president and the vice president's assumption of his powers, would not be adopted until 1967. With the exception of his ability to cast a vote to break a tie in the Senate, the document that created the office attached to it not a single specific power. Provisions in the Constitution, moreover, stand in the way of a vice president's acquiring power. Its very first lines, Article 1, Section 1, state that all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, and the Congress shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives, and that the Senate shall be composed of two senators from each state, of senators only, no mention of a vice president. The Founding Fathers were concerned that the mere fact of the vice president presiding over the Senate might blur the overarching principle of separation of powers, that the office, as Hugh Williamson of North Carolina put it during the Constitutional Convention of 1787, would then mix too much of the legislative and executive, which ought to be kept as separate as possible. In particular, as one study of the office put it, the founders seemed to fear that the president would somehow gain ascendance over the Senate through the vice president. They needn't have worried. Nobody could have been a more staunch guardian of the separation principle, more fiercely jealous of its independence from the executive branch. The Senate, the Constitution says, makes its own rules, and its rules, together with its precedents, grant only to senators, and, upon appropriate notice, former presidents, the right to address the body or to participate in debate. It doesn't give that right to a vice president. He could sit in the presiding officer's chair in the Senate. He couldn't be a part of it, couldn't even speak on the floor except with its consent. As for the authority given him by his right of presiding over it, the Senate had, after some decades in the early 19th century in which vice presidents had indeed intruded, taken care that its rules and precedents would in future keep such intrusion by the executive branch to a minimum. Had done so with such thoroughness that, in fact, by 1960, a vice president possessed no significant power that couldn't be exercised just as well by the newest freshman senator if he was presiding in the vice president's place. And, in fact, with vice presidents having little taste for the almost purely ceremonial role, it was often freshman senators who were assigned to sit in the presiding officer's chair. Article 1 of the Constitution deals with legislative powers. Article 2 deals with executive powers. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America, states the article's first lines. In the president, not in any manner in the vice president. Succeeding sections of that article enumerate the presidential powers, to act as a commander-in-chief of the armed forces, for example, or to veto legislation passed by Congress, or to grant pardons. No provision in the Constitution authorizes a president to delegate any of these powers, any of the executive power, to a vice president. Even should Congress wish to, it can't get around that barrier. Any formal allocation of power to the vice president would conflict with the clause in the Constitution vesting the undivided executive power in the president, stated one study of the situation. There was, moreover, a further barrier. The various great departments of government, not only the Department of Agriculture, the Department of the Interior, all the departments whose heads sat as the president's cabinet, but other major, if non-cabinet-level federal agencies as well had been established by law, by statutes enacted by Congress. In establishing these departments, Congress had laid out boundaries, statutory boundaries, of their authority. Powers delegated to a vice president by a president might infringe on those statutory powers. This conflict, and the weakness of the vice president's role in it, had become clear during a president's attempt to give his vice president what was accurately called the only big job ever handed a vice president during the almost two centuries the United States had been in existence. The executive order that Franklin Roosevelt issued in July 1941, after, with war looming, he had declared a state of national emergency. By virtue of the existence of the emergency, he created an economic defense board to coordinate planning for the looming war with broad powers over areas such as imports, exports, and the stockpiling of strategic materials, and made Vice President Henry A. Wallace its chairman, in a position that gave Wallace broad authority in such areas. No sooner had the board been created, however, than the inherent conflict between the vice president's role and the powers of other cabinet members had erupted in open hostility. In their conflict with Wallace, the cabinet members had Congress behind them. No president since then had made any similar attempt. As for the possibility of a president making a more informal delegation of powers to a vice president, that possibility was hazy. Nothing specific stood in the way of his being given major responsibilities within the executive branch, should the president wish to do so, but there was a practical consideration that might make him reluctant to do so. Under the Constitution, the vice president is not a subordinate of the president. The document mentions only one method of removing a vice president from office, through impeachment by Congress. It confers on a president no power to remove him, as he could remove a cabinet officer, for example, should he use the delegated powers to initiate policies that conflicted with a president's wishes, or to defy a president. For a president to confer power on someone whom he can fire is one thing. Conferring power on someone he can't fire is a risk, and a big one. At the beginning of 1961, the vice president had only one position to which he was entitled by law, membership in the National Security Council, a body that had been created not to make decisions, but to advise a president. Kennedy had proposed that another law be passed that would make Lyndon Johnson not merely a member, but chairman of the National Aeronautics and Space Council, but this too was an advisory, not a decision-making body. Kennedy also told Johnson that he wanted him to succeed his predecessor Vice President, Nixon, in another virtually powerless role, the chairmanship of a committee monitoring racial discrimination in government contracts. When Johnson analyzed the three positions he would be holding, he discovered something very quickly, George Reedy says, that they carried with them only a derivative power of the president. He discovered that none of the power was his, that any power that a vice president has is just power which has been given him by a president and can be taken back. When, shortly after his inauguration, Johnson asked Deputy Attorney General Nicholas de Belleville Katzenbach for a study of other possible duties in the executive branch, he would be told that the nature and number of those duties are, as a practical matter, within the discretion of the president. In later decades, the role of the vice president would be gradually and substantially enlarged, at the discretion of the president. But at the time of the 1960 election, that was where the office stood. No legislative powers, no executive powers, and obstacles, hitherto insurmountable obstacles, to obtaining any, except what the president might choose to give him. But power is where power goes. Hardly had he been elected to the vice presidency than Lyndon Johnson launched a campaign, unprecedented in American history on several levels, that, had it succeeded, would not only have dramatically transformed the nature of the office, but would also, in the process, have undermined the concept of the separation of executive and legislative powers embedded in the Constitution. The Lyndon Johnson who was maneuvering for power now, however, wasn't the Lyndon Johnson who, throughout most of his career, had calculated so thoughtfully, made his moves so subtly, demonstrated always so deft a hand when he was seeking power. He was the Lyndon Johnson of the last year or two, when, with the great prize so close at last, the fear of failure so great, he had made over and over again the stops and starts, the frantic flurries of desperation, when he would listen to nothing he didn't want to hear, when you couldn't reason with him. The campaign had two fronts, a mile and a half apart on Pennsylvania Avenue. One was on Capitol Hill. The formal conference, or caucus, of the Senate's Democratic members had traditionally been presided over by the senator who had been elected their leader. Johnson, of course, had been the conference chairman for the past 8 years. Now Johnson asked the senator who was to succeed him as majority leader, his assistant leader Mike Mansfield, to allow him to continue as conference chairman. He assured Mansfield that the chairmanship would be merely a symbolic honor in recognition of his past services, a pro forma position, as Mansfield was to put it. Johnson may have said, he was to use this argument later, that since the Constitution already gave the vice president the duty of presiding over the Senate as a whole, presiding over a party caucus was only another similar function. Persuading Mansfield was not difficult. The Montanan was a quiet, accommodating, philosophical man who, as one writer noted, owed his prominence in the Senate solely to Johnson's selection of him as his assistant leader, and who in that job had had, as he himself said, no work to do. He, Johnson, kept control even when he went to Texas through his conduit, Bobby Baker. Taking Johnson at his word, in my view, Mansfield was to say, this would constitute only an honorary position and I had no objection. He agreed. This in itself would have been a revolutionary step. As Evans and Novak were to say, Mansfield was agreeing to do what no other Senate had ever done, breach the constitutional separation of powers by making the vice president the presiding officer of all the Senate Democrats whenever they met in formal conference. But Johnson was not, in fact, intending the chairmanship to be pro forma at all, as became clearer when he also persuaded Mansfield to let him retain what was to Washington the symbol of his senatorial power, his awesome Taj Mahal office. Although this office, convenient to the Senate chamber, had been the majority leader's office, Mansfield agreed to let Johnson keep using it, saying he himself would be more comfortable operating from a less pretentious suite. Then it was announced that the conduit through which the power flowed would remain in place as well. Bobby Baker would stay on as secretary for the majority. Mansfield's personality made the persuasion easy. As Larry O'Brien was to put it, I think that Mansfield inherited Baker passively. Baker had the job, and he wouldn't throw him out any more than he would demand the majority leader's office and that the vice president remove himself from it. But Johnson also had to persuade senators far less malleable than Mansfield, and that proved a very different story. Sometime in December, with Mansfield's agreement secured, Johnson invited four longtime senatorial allies, Robert Kerr, Hubert Humphrey, George Smathers, and Richard Russell, to a meeting not in the Capitol, but in a private dining room at the Sheraton Carlton Hotel, probably hoping, as Humphrey puts it, to keep it a secret, and told them of his plan to retain the caucus chairmanship. It was obvious to the four senators that Johnson's plans for the post included more than merely presiding over the caucus. He had often controlled, constantly influenced, the course of legislation from that powerful position for 8 years, Humphrey was to say, and now he was planning to continue doing so, to use the chairmanship, in Humphrey's words, to hang on to the power he had wielded as majority leader, as a de facto majority leader. Johnson had the illusion that he could be, in a sense, as vice president, the majority leader. His proposal violated what was to these senators one of the Senate's most sacred precepts, its independence of the executive branch. He was proposing that a member of that branch preside over their meetings. Misgivings were voiced, but, as Humphrey puts it, Johnson was not an easy man to tell you can't do something, and he evidently felt he had persuaded his old allies. Summoned to the Taj Mahal, Baker found a buoyancy about him that lately had been missing. "Bobby," he said, "I've been thinking about where I can do Jack Kennedy the most good. And it's right here on this hill. All those Bostons and Harvards don't know any more about Capitol Hill than an old maid does about fucking. I'm going to keep this office and help Mike Mansfield and Bob Kerr and Hubert Humphrey pass the Kennedy program. It's going to be just the way it was. You can keep on helping me like you've always done. Bobby, I'm working it out." And, in fact, had Johnson's plan succeeded, in many ways it would indeed have been just the way it was. In several conversations during this period, he also mentioned, seemingly casually, that he planned to sit in on meetings of the Democratic Policy and Steering Committees. These committees, the first, known for years as Johnson's rubber stamp, exercised considerable control over the fate of legislation Democratic senators wanted passed. The second had absolute control over the committee assignments crucial to senators' careers, had been keys to his domination of his party's senators. Most of their members had been his allies, long accustomed to accede to his wishes. That was why they were on the committees. He had always been able to count on them to do his bidding, and evidently felt they would continue to do so. Had his plan succeeded, although he would no longer be majority leader in name, both of these key instruments through which he had controlled the Senate would still be in his hands, not in those of the amenable Mansfield. He was going to be vice president and majority leader, Ken O'Donnell says. And if he was, if the vice president was also the leader of the Senate majority, the vice president would possess a source of power totally outside the executive branch. Power separate from and independent of the president. Kennedy would not be able to deal with him as if he was merely a subordinate. Johnson had told Baker that he was keeping the caucus leadership to help Jack Kennedy's program. But what if he opposed some aspect of that program, this leader with a firm control of the Senate? His opposition might have behind it an institution that, as he had already demonstrated, could be quite successful in opposing a president. However, Johnson's belief that his plan would be accepted was only another example of how his loss of confidence had eroded his gift. Certain though he was that it would succeed, it never really had much of a chance. When Baker heard it, he was to recall, "I was both astonished and horrified. If anyone knew the United States Senate, its proud members and its proud traditions, it was Lyndon B. Johnson. Surely he knew that the prerogatives of membership were jealously guarded, that no member of the executive branch, even a Lyndon Johnson, would be welcomed in. Though I saw a disaster in the making," Baker says, "when he attempted to interpose reservations, I had a hard time doing so." Having worked himself up into believing that the plan would succeed, willed himself into the state in which he believed that whatever was in his mind was reality, Johnson just talked over him. Blinded by his plans, his ego, and his past Senate successes, Baker says, he refused to listen to anything he didn't want to hear. As had been the case ever since he had accepted the vice presidential nomination, in fact, this revving up was at a level of intensity rare even for him. Baker had often seen him in what he calls a manic mood. This time, he says, Johnson seemed excessively manic. An aspect of the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and power that had been evident through his life was that the more of it he got, the more intoxicated he became with it. Now, he had had a lot of it, my God, running the world, and had had it for a long time. The 8 years he had been the Democratic leader of the Senate, minority and majority. And there was on Capitol Hill an understanding that he had restored the Senate to respect it had not enjoyed for more than a century, that he had transformed the institution from something very near a joke into a force to be reckoned with, and had therefore transformed its members as well, so that being a senator now meant so much more than before. Surely he felt these men wouldn't want to go back to the situation that existed before he became leader. He had boasted to his aides that he had the old bulls who ran the Senate in the palm of his hand, and indeed he did. The feelings of many of them toward him were almost paternal. As long as he had them behind him, the more junior senators didn't much signify. But he felt the juniors, too, must of course